Thank you for helping us make Budget and for more than 5 million downloads of Issues Etc. in 2018. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 11 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support of Issues Etc., live and on demand, and for our 24/7 talk and music stations. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's difficult for ethics to keep a handle on the advance, or what is usually portrayed as the advance, of science. We've been hearing for several years about the ability to edit the human genome, to edit human genes. And there are places where there are either legal or social regulations that would hold this in check. And then there are places where, well, almost anything can happen that could happen when it comes to this new frontier. We're going to be talking about a recent conference on human gene editing. Dr. William Hurlbut joins us. He's adjunct professor and senior research scholar in neurobiology at the Stanford Medical School, formerly served on the President's Council for Bioethics, and is author of the book Altered Nuclear Transfer. Dr. Hurlbut, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What disturbed you most about what came out of the recent International Summit on Human Genome Editing?
Well, it was an interesting situation because I actually knew something about what was coming. At least I had intuitions about it because I know the scientist who did the work, and he had come to see me at Stanford and talked with me in general terms about what he was ramping up to. I did not know that he had implanted human embryos into a mother's womb and had done genetic engineering of the human germline. But when the announcement was made, and it was not really an announcement, it was a leaked revelation of research that he had intended to publish later. But once it was leaked, it became the major focus of the International Gene Summit Conference. And it was a very big event. I mean, it was very dramatic being there. I think we all felt, there were about 1,000 people convened there, and we all felt as though we were at the epicenter of the human story for at least that week's chapter of it. It was very dramatic. And what was disturbing about it was the feeling that we collectively as a species and as a global civilization had not addressed the challenging issues that were suddenly sprung upon us.
So what exactly did this researcher do with the technology that was available to him?
There is a dramatic advance in gene editing technology called CRISPR-Cas9. It was co-invented by a molecular biologist at UC Berkeley named Jennifer Doudna, who is a very nice person, very interesting and thoughtful person. I'm doing a project with her to address these ethical and social issues, so I know Jennifer quite well. And she has a sincere concern and conscience about these matters. And because she understands the power of this new technology, what used to be very difficult to do and very expensive and imprecise has now suddenly become a technology capable of altering the DNA of any creature on Earth, and in a way that is inexpensive in the sense that it can be done basically by any reasonably trained scientist with a small budget and fairly precisely. So this means that suddenly we've got the power to intervene in human genetics. That has very, very positive implications for direct treatment of patients with genetic diseases like sickle cell anemia and cystic fibrosis. But of course, there's other possibility, and that is that we go back to the level of the human embryo at its very beginning, or even further back to the sperm and the egg that converge to make the human embryo, and alter genetics at that level. The difference being that if you alter the genetics at that level, it's passed on to the next generation. So you're actually getting into the process of the future of humanity, not just an individual patient.
Do we know enough about the human genome to be employing this technology?
we know enough to be treating patients with diseases in the sense that those are desperate situations and they would justify a certain amount of risk. I don't think we know enough at this stage, have not considered carefully enough to be intervening at the germline level, in other words, influencing the gene pool of the future of humanity. That's something we need to do much more carefully and with much more collective consideration. So when I met with the scientist who did this work, whose name is Dr. Hu, but we call him JK because his first name is John Key. JK, he's a very nice person. I had very long meetings with him at Stanford, and I cautioned him that I didn't think he should be proceeding in this way, but he had other arguments and other thoughts about it, and he did proceed.
Is there anything, we're talking about international scientists here, we're talking about, you know, there is no organization that can write regulations or even guidelines for such things with the reasonable expectation that such things would be observed and respected. What can we do to stop what sounds like, in some cases, a strong potential abuse of this technology that otherwise could be used very beneficially for the health of individuals?
Yes, well, there are many issues involved in that. Starting from the very foundation, there's the issue of doing research with human embryos in order to ramp up to be able to do this kind of intervention, which raises ethical issues of its own, obviously. The second issues are the risks associated with the procedure itself. Are they going to try to repair a gene that's defective and make things worse or cause other what they call off-target effects, which would, in other words, change other DNA than what they were targeting? And then there are obviously a great many questions about the relationship between parents and the rights to intervene in prospective children as they come, as they're made in a dish. You don't want to turn procreation into reproduction and then on to production of babies. Of course, it raises the strange issues of whether it should be used for interventions and things that go beyond diseases, but into traits themselves or sort of beneficial things, but not necessarily worthy of the risks associated with them. Where do you intervene? Do you call dyslexia a disease? Dyslexia has some genetic component. Is depression a disease? Well, yes, it is. But on the other hand, is intervening in the tendency to get depression, which does have some genetic components, justifiable? So there are many issues here. And how to regulate them is extremely complicated, not just because the issues are complicated, but because the international cooperation on these and different cultural attitudes regarding them make it a very complex issue from the beginning.
Doesn't, at some level, everything have some genetic component to it, not necessarily determinative, but some genetic component?
Well, you said that well, because determinative is the misimpression. There are very few traits that are determined in strict linear fashion from any single gene. Well, red hair, for example, is very limited genetics. You could probably make people with red hair if you wanted. But most traits that we care about, intelligence, longevity, appearance, beauty kinds of issues, those are very, very complicated expressions of many, many genes, in most cases probably hundreds or maybe thousands of interacting genes. I mean, you see, the thing is that genes designate proteins. That's the simplistic version of it, but genes produce proteins, okay, and the proteins interact with other proteins, and it's a little bit like paints on the palette of an artist. Very rarely does he dip his brush in and take a pure color and put it onto the canvas. It usually mixes the colors in the same way the proteins mix to produce all the nuances and grades of expression that go into human development. So yes, it's not easy to know what you're doing even with given genes. They affect every gene affects many traits in the expression of a human being. And beyond that, almost all traits are the mixing of many different genes combining their power. So determinism is not appropriate here, and that means that interventions are a much more complex and subtle process than some people would imagine.
You say that one in your interaction with JK, one of the questions he asked you was, why is there such a concern in America over experimenting on human embryos? Why do you think he asked that, and how did you respond to him?
Well, for J.K., he's part of his own cultural heritage, which has used abortion as a tool of social policy for decades, and the valuing of human life is not grounded in the same cultural tradition as ours is, and in that sense, China doesn't have the constraints on moral concerns about the embryo in the same way we do. There are, of course, people who take that position in China. There are an estimated 100 million Christians, many of whom would share concerns that you and I would have about embryo destruction. But J.K. grew up in a different environment, and he didn't see those. And so when I said, well, look, J.K., the embryo is the beginning of a human life. It's a human being at its earliest stages of development. And while we were talking, this was while he was visiting me at Stanford, he put his thumb and forefinger together to show me the size of the embryo. And he said, you're telling me that something that size has the same importance as a human child? And I said to him, well, J.K., your children started out that size too, and you and I did too. And so, I mean, that was an interesting moment in the conversation. He's actually a really nice guy. I like him personally, and he's, I think, a well-meaning scientist. It just comes from a different series of encouragements and education and cultural foundations, which means what you started with in this conversation is all the more important. We need to collectively, as a civilization, a global civilization, start addressing these challenges.
Do you get the sense that of the 1,000 or so that were gathered there in Hong Kong to discuss human gene editing, and then, as you say, with the leak of this information, it became kind of took over the conference. Do you get the sense that there is a collective alarm or apathy? Well, certainly they're excited by the science, but ethical apathy toward these things. Where would you gauge that? Where would you put that needle?
I would say there is a very strong response to what J.K. did that has been awakened, not just in the scientific community, but in the general public. And that's one of the positive things he did. Whatever he did, whatever way of evaluation we put on it, he did us all a favor by, at least in the regard that we now have it on our radar. We now know we need to address this. Within the scientific community, there's very serious concern that bad mistakes will be made that will damage human beings and put the science under a bad light. So I think that's good. There's going to be some deep discussion. It'll be very difficult. But that discussion needs to be about much more than safety and medical procedure. It needs to be a discussion that goes to the very bottom of the question. Because as you may have seen, even as high-order individuals and knowledgeable scientists, as Francis Collins, head of the NIH, said after this event, we need to even think about whether this ever should be done for any purpose. It's not a slam-dunk condition that we need to just get this safe. We need to ask ourselves, what does this mean for the human role and relationship with the created order and the individual lives and social process that this would have impact on? Certainly, we need to also be attentive to the dangers of this, because once it comes out as a accepted medical procedure, if that happens, it's going to then very quickly be taken up by fertility clinics and by all sorts of different commercial interests and individual intentions and ambitions, and it will not be contained easily. So we need to take very seriously the foundational thoughts and later the governance if this is going to be put into place.
Dr. William Hurlbut is adjunct professor and senior research scholar in neurobiology at the Stanford Medical School. He formerly served on the President's Council on Bioethics, and he's author of the book Altered Nuclear Transfer. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Hurlbut, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
When we come back, Rebecca Curtis is going to join us. She's written recently for Touchstone Magazine a column titled Birthing Room, Maternity in Literature, and Our Need to Find Better Words for Large Families. We'll talk about maternity, large families in literature. Thank you for helping us make Budget and for more than 5 million downloads of Issues Etc. in 2018. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 11 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support of Issues Etc., live and on demand, and for our 24/7 talk and music stations.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.